Okay.
And good morning, everyone. And if the marshal would introduce the panel, you may do so now, please. Thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Bradfold, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Randall Sleater presiding.
And good morning again, everyone, and welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals. And so far, we've had fairly good luck through the spring and summer with our technology. But of course, if anything happens, which at times can, you'll note that we do have the clock in the corner box. Can both counsel see the clock fine?
I can, Your Honor.
Okay. And I think Mr. Burkholdt said yes, although he was muted.
Yes.
But okay, very good. Obviously, if we lose hearing you in particular, but also sight, but particular hearing, we will have the marshal stop the clock and we'll reconnect and restart once we get you back successfully on board. But otherwise, the process that we'll be using is the same that you're accustomed to. The appellant's counsel at 15 minutes, respondent 15, and then 5 minutes for appellant rebuttal if you choose. We do prohibit recording of these proceedings because we're doing so. So whether parties, counsel, or participants, including any guests or observers, may not record the proceeding. We do ask once you're, at least at the point at which you're not speaking, to mute, because that seems to help technologically. And you'll notice the judges, we do the same thing. And I'll just note, for the record, this first case, A20-0476, is the first of two oral matters we have on our calendar today. We have four non-oral matters. We will also be considering Kyle Wendell, LC Appellant versus Auto Owners Insurance Company, who is respondent. And so, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If it may please the court, counsel, attorney Jacob Burkholdt, representing Kyle Else, appellant. The issue before the court is a pre and primarily pre-judgment interest that applies in this case. The issue is what statute applies. I believe there's no dispute 549.09 applies in this case. And that is because it specifically is authorized by law, unless it is done by contract or a different statute applies. So in this case, the parties seem to focus their arguments on the issue of Poehler and Lessard, those two cases. It is appellant's position that 549.09 applies and should be awarding pre-judgment interest. Again, that's the primary focus, but pre- and post-judgment interest. I'll say there's a little dispute on exactly how that's calculated by the district court and appellant, but for purposes of this case, the primary issue is from the respondent that Lessard somehow limits the damages by contract. That seems to be the only main argument by auto owners in this case, the focus on Lessard. And for several reasons why Poehler applies and Lessard does not. Lessard is older in time. It is a UIM claim, not a fire claim. And Lessard is probably distinguishable, most importantly, on the language of the contract in Lessard, which is the primary difference in this case. There's no no contract language in this that would, I believe the Lessard language is all sums and all damages that limits 549.09. And therefore, in this case, auto owners does not have the Lessard language. I think it's very important to point out that in the respondent's brief, there is almost no discussion on the language in the auto owner's contract. If the court reviews the actual language, it would look that it does not mimic Lessard in any way.
Mr. Burkholdt, let me ask you about that for a second.
Yes.
When I read auto owner's brief, it seems to me that they actually are responding to your argument about the differences in policy language, and they rely on this third section for how property, how losses are settled. I know you're familiar with the farm pack insurance policy. Relevant parts are in our addendum. So that third section has to do when replacement cost is shown in the declarations page. And this is a replacement cost policy. That was so evident in your first appeal and throughout your trial. And as the language that auto owners relies on goes down to sub three, where it says, in no event shall we pay more than the limit of insurance shown in the declarations for coverage C for all loss and damage in any one loss. So you're right, it's certainly different from the language in Lessard, but it's not all sums, but it is all loss and damage. And I didn't see a response from you in your reply brief to that language. I mean, you argue that there's now an ambiguity, and I don't know that I agree with you. It seems pretty clear that it's this third section of how losses are settled that applies in this case. So would you help me out on that?
Certainly, Your Honor. It's actually, I know the court seemed to indicate it was a replacement cost policy. The actual court order, if you look at Judge Better's order and the special verdict and the subsequent orders, it is actual cash value that the court makes its award. And so subdivision three does not apply.
Well, that's not true though, counsel, because subdivision three has an actual cash value option. So you got to read the whole subdivision, right? So would you go back though and address the policy language question? You want to compare the Lessard policy to the policy here. So please compare it. I want to hear your analysis. Thank you.
And maybe I need to find that subdivision three language, Your Honor, to do that. And I do think that it's important that, let's see, the losses are settled. Looking at subdivision 3C. Just we're operating under the same.
That's right. That was the argument in the respondent's brief.
Right. More than the limit for all loss and damage in one particular loss. And I think, Your Honor, I think the point is that this interest in the loss, there's nothing that says that this particular loss. I understand the Lessard language is that this is a prejudgment interest is a compensatory loss, and that somehow prejudgment interest falls into that particular limit in this particular case. And so somehow the policy limits limit this argument. And so I don't believe that the language with the smallest of applies because it doesn't say and it doesn't reference the particular damage, although it does reference all loss and damage in one particular loss. So we don't believe that particular language is limiting in this case. I think there's some ambiguity, again, as you note, Your Honor, between the way the special verdict form reads and the way that the court particularly finds and awards the loss in this case.
Counsel, can I follow up on that? Shouldn't we be focusing on the language of the contract, though? In, you know, your argument is that the language of this insurance policy is different than the language from that in Lessard. And it, you know, as Judge Bratfold correctly noted, for personal property, the declaration says that it's a replacement cost. It on page one of your addendum, if you look at household personal property coverage C, it says replacement cost. So doesn't that necessarily mean that we're not under section one in the addendum on page 33, but we're in section three because it's three says when replacement cost is shown in the declarations as applicable to coverage C, which is, I think, what the case is here. Three then applies. So why doesn't the language in three that limits the policy to no more than the insurance shown in the declarations, why isn't that language applicable, given that we're under three?
Well, again, I guess I would take issue that this ends up being a replacement cost case because the court looks back. It's interesting. There is a there was $30,000 of replacement cost damages that were awarded over and above the $122,000 of actual cash value. And that amount was the replacement cost value that was awarded and that the district court found. And I think that's...
But following up then, doesn't that go to paragraph D that talks about we shall pay no more than the actual cash value of the property until actual repair or replacement of such property is completed? So, you know, aren't we still effectively under three, not one? I guess I'm struggling to see how we can ever be under one given the declaration. But help me out here.
Certainly. I think the challenge is that the party argued through counsel, Mr. Tobin and Ottawa's at trial, that this was never a replacement cost only policy and that this was an actual cash value or replacement cost. And since the jury awarded both, I don't know how the court can just simply ignore the award. And so it appears that it's both. If it were not, then actual cash value would never have been given to the jury and auto owners would never have allowed that special verdict question to get there. And I think
you need the actual cash value because of paragraph D and three?
No, that was never argued, Your Honor. That was not presented or argued. That paragraph, you're referring to 3D?
Yes, that's correct.
And that language, if the full cost to replace all damage covered exceeds, we'll pay no more than the actual cash value until actual repair or replacement?
Correct.
I understand that's the language, but that has, I guess, never been clarified or argued to the district court in that sense. The court awarded the actual cash value and then separately the replacement cost to come to the total amount. And so I think the question was Lessard overruled by Poehler? And if Poehler, again, I think it would be an interpretation argument to say that Poehler, which again, arguably overrules Lessard from that standpoint, it's a UIM claim and the fire statute would 65A says it would have to be.
Mr. Burkholz, would you point me to the language in Poehler that you believe overruled Lessard? Because I don't see that language. And it seems to me the issues decided in Poehler are really quite different from the one you're arguing today. And you could, if you just give me a citation, that will help. I didn't see that in your brief either.
Well, I mean, I think it doesn't specifically say that. So I think if the argument is that we're overruling Lessard, it does not say that explicitly in Poehler. I think the point of Poehler is that it's that UIM claim and that 65A01 are very different creatures. And that because in a fire policy, it says interest must be payable under 65A01, then auto owners can't contract around 65A01 unless done so explicitly. It says has to be paid with interest from the time. And that's, I guess, Lessard on 144, 145, Poehler on 144, 145.
So now you're really saying that Poehler, if I follow you, but you know, tell me if I'm not, that Poehler applies because the standard fire policy applies in this case. We have an auto owner's policy that doesn't speak to pre-verdict or pre-judgment interest. And you're saying the standard fire policy fills in the gaps and gives us the minimum, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so that's a little different argument from what the Lessard argument that I heard earlier. So here's the question I want to ask you, because it was a point made by the district court and then auto owners also made it in their brief, all right? According to them, if the standard fire policy applied, and they have really specific language they point to, actually, you know, Mr. Else would be in a worse spot because interest would not start accruing until after first that written notice of claim, and then second, the award is filed. So in this case, it would be the filing of the jury verdict or judgment after the jury verdict. So, you know, you'd lose 4 years of interest if the standard fire policy applied. So I'm confused why you would make that argument, but maybe I'm probably missing something in your interpretation of the standard fire policy. So help me out.
Well, I think it's interesting when they say it's the losses due and payable. And that's, I think, perhaps where Your Honor was coming out of when the losses shall become payable. And therefore, I recall Mr. Tobin and auto owners making that argument. So it was never a dispute that this under the auto owners, again, policy, right? So I understand what the court is saying, that, well, you're picking one provision perhaps from the contract and one provision from 65A01. But when it comes back to where the gap, there is no gap in the policy as to when it should be paid. And then when it comes back to, well, when does interest from the time, it's that it has to have interest. I think the question then isn't that, well, we're taking the exact quote from 65A01 and then inserting it back into the policy. I also take issue with it isn't payable. And that was never really developed, only after a verdict is entered. Once the jury found, it would have become and was payable at the time of February 13th, 2015. It was due and payable. I know auto owners takes issue with that, but there's no law or citation I've ever read that says it's only due and payable when the judge orders it. Essentially, that would remove interest, I guess, from any claim that anyone ever makes on a fire policy simply because the insurance company refuses to pay. I've never understood that argument that the payable part is only when judgment is entered, because remember, the jury found that there was no interference with the policy. And if the jury verdict is upheld, then it was due and payable on February 13, 2015. So I don't see that as limiting any argument by Mr. Else that the interest would not be due. I understand that was kind of a side comment by the district court and by Mr. Tobin that was never ruled upon. But it is our position that 65A01 would fill in the gap. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Burkholz. And you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose. Mr. Tobin, for a respondent, you may identify yourself for the record, please, and then proceed.
I'm unmuted now. Yes. All right.
Correct. Thank you.
Technology is wonderful. May it please the court, counsel Tim Tobin on behalf of Auto Owners Insurance Company. I'd like to begin, I guess, just to follow the thread that we left off with the last bit of Mr. Burkholz's argument. And the real issue there is what the Minnesota Standard Fire Insurance Policy says is that the loss shall become payable once the insured and the insurer reach an agreement on the amount, or it's determined in arbitration or in litigation. And then the insurance company has 30 days, or pardon me, under the Standard Fire Policy, 60 days to pay that amount. And they don't owe interest at all until they're late in their payment under that schedule. And here, the auto owner's money was paid within that period of time or shortly thereafter, and it would indeed dramatically limit the amount of interest that the insured in this case would have. Back to the matter at hand, it really is a relatively simple question, I believe. There is no issue that I'm aware of with regard to post-judgment interest. I don't know where Mr. Burkholz came up with that, but I think the only issue before this court is whether the limit in the auto owner's policy caps the total amount that they must pay, including the amount of the personal property loss that was determined by the jury, plus prejudgment interest. And we concede we owe theoretically some prejudgment interest. And the only question is whether all of that is capped by the limit or only whether the damages are capped by that limit and the prejudgment interest award is unlimited. It's that simple. And I cite to the language of the Lessard decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and it is clear, unvarnished. We conclude that an insured, in the absence of any statutory command to the contrary, may not recover pre-award interest, which, when added to total damages, would exceed the monetary limitation on liability contained in the insured's policy. The actual language of the limit in Lessard was never quoted in the case that I'm aware of. And so to compare the language is a little bit difficult. But it seems to me that the court, through your questions, has zeroed in on the applicable language here, and that is, in no event shall we pay more than the limit of insurance shown in the declarations for coverage C for all loss and damage in any one loss. Damage. It is unquestioned that pre-award, pre-judgment interest is deemed an element of damages. It's all over the case law. And I'll just go back to Lessard, but it's only one example of this. An element of compensatory as an element of compensatory damages, pre-judgment interest is plainly subject to any applicable limitation on liability for such damages.
Can you address appellant's argument that the award that the district court made was the actual cash value, and therefore paragraph one of the policy should apply instead of three?
Sure. Your earlier question was spot on. Paragraph three, the introductory language says, when replacement cost is shown in the declarations, we shall pay the full cost, blah, blah, blah. And it goes on A, B, and C. So the predicate to that is this a policy where replacement cost is shown in the declarations? If the answer to that is yes, it doesn't matter whether the insured is entitled to actual cash value or replacement cost. Replacement cost is shown in the declarations. That's what triggers paragraph three. But frankly, there's similar language applicable to the others, which basically says, you go to paragraph one, and no event shall we pay more than the smallest of either A, the limit of insurance applying to the damaged covered property. Now, I admit it uses a little different language about damaged covered property, but that's only because two and three do not apply. Paragraph three certainly discusses replacement cost and actual cost value, and the jury made an award on a replacement cost or RCV basis. That's an amount that Mr. Else is entitled to recover. It simply operates in the nature of a declaratory judgment because it's not payable until the property is actually replaced, but it is an award to him that he can collect on. And as Mr. Burkholz well knows, auto owners paid that full amount, waiving its right to proof of replacement of the damaged property. The jury made a determination as to the RCV amount of the personal property. That was a claim.
So Mr. Tobin, yes. Let's assume for a minute that we agree with you and that Lessard is controlling in this case, and that we reject the appellant's arguments on Polar as well. So that really leaves us with looking at the district court's computation of interest. And the appellants have raised some questions there that I didn't see fully addressed in your brief, but maybe I missed it. So that's why I want to ask about it. So our district court here, we all know that accrual of the pre-verdict or pre-judgment interest, the date of accrual is really important. And the district court found that Mr. Else made written notice of claim on April 15th, 2015. In fact, if I read the record right, I think that was the proposed finding that you gave the district court, and the district court adopted it, April 15th, 2015. So what confuses me is I don't see anything in the record that supports April 15th. And the appellants did challenge that. They said that the correct date should be February 13th with an additional 3 days. So what is, did the district court clearly err in using April 15th, or are we focused now on your argument from the Nelson case where we add 60 days? So just help me out. I didn't really follow that because I don't see anything in the record that says that Mr. Else gave written notice on April 15th. There's nothing there.
Your Honor, I'm not terribly familiar with the intricate facts on that, and I'm not sure that I can answer that question for you. Doesn't it become academic if the premise of your question is if you agree with us, we end up owing the limit no matter what?
Counselor, so you have reached the limit on the larger part of the loss, which has to do with personal property, but not on ALE, which, I mean, you're right. That's peanuts, perhaps. But that you're not really helping me because I still want to understand whether the district court clearly erred. You did try to address this argument in the brief with the Nelson case, and it made no sense to me. So I just thought maybe you would help me out today, but I'm just looking for whatever you can.
I'm sorry. I will be candid with the court. I move firms. I am working with a very limited record with regard to what was put before this court. You have more in front of you than I do, unfortunately. I know the issue that is of most importance to my client, and I'll just be candid. Honestly, Your Honor, I don't recall that argument, and I don't recall the specifics of it or how we got to April 15th, and it's our loss if we can't.
We'll go based on the brief and the record, counsel. I thanks for your explanation. I do appreciate it. Thank you.
And hopefully you appreciate my candor as well, but I don't like to say I'm unprepared, but on that issue I am. I think it's important to point out, I've got a little bit of time left and I'm not sure that the court has any other questions, but you know, again, we go back to the fact that prejudgment interest is compensatory, and this is the majority rule, as both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court in Lazard pointed out. And the only difference, or the only case that they could find that went in the other direction, was a case out of Michigan. And it had this, it did not have the statutory language that says except as otherwise provided by contract. And it's clear that what Lazard was saying, and by the way, Lazard was not overruled by Paler, which I understand is the correct pronunciation of that case. It was not overruled by Paler. In fact, Paler cited Lazard, not for this point, but for something similar. So to suggest that Paler in any way affects the Lazard decision is just not consistent with the Supreme Court's decision. But there was an amendment, or there was a new statute, the 72A, which was enacted after the Lazard decision, and it specifically says interest is owed regardless of whether it exceeds the limit or not, which I think is a pretty clear indication from the legislature that they'd already gotten the Lazard decision. Now they're putting in this new statute, which has a statement that says the limit doesn't control. They were accepting as that proposition that 549.09 is capped by the limit of the applicable insurance policy. And I think that point should be made as well. And beyond that, I don't think that I really have anything to say on the primary issue unless the panel has further questions.
It doesn't appear there are any other questions. Judge Cochran, did you have a question?
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Tobin. Then we'll turn back to Mr. Burkholz. If you wish, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Appellant, I want to focus on, I think, some of the details in the numbers and the payments that maybe aren't exceptionally clear. If the court, for whatever reason, rejects the argument that the language of the contract and the statute do not allow any interest outside of the limits here, we should be careful of what limits and what payments we're talking about. We have several different limits and several different awards. And I think it's very, very important that we not fall into several of those traps. The amounts that there was a $10,000 payment, that was for living expenses. So that can't come off the personal property award. So, you know, that needs to be very carefully addressed in terms of what amounts are offset in terms of calculating the interest. So
Mr. Burkholz, you're now talking about that the second issue, I think, in your brief, which has to do with the computation of interest. And you make some interesting arguments about how Mr. Else is entitled to compound interest and that Mr. Else is entitled to the common law application of payments to principal or interest. Now, I don't see anything in your district court submissions that where you raise that issue below to the district court.
That's true, that was not raised.
Okay, so you know that our court generally does not review issues that are not raised in the district court. Now, maybe we'll go ahead and review your issue. It's been briefed by both parties, but it is one that we normally wouldn't do. So can you give me some basis? I mean, part of what I'm concerned about, quite frankly, Mr. Burkholz, is that much of your computation argument, as was pointed out by Mr. Tobin, it runs up against the fact that, you know, if we apply the policy limit, at least to the property damage part, you know, it's not going to make any appreciable difference for you. Makes maybe a little bit of difference on the ALE, but even that is a pretty small number. So help me out in understanding the significance of the dollars we're talking about.
The significant dollars, the court, well, I mean, we're talking the total dollars here of, again, $55,000 to $65,000. I think the district court focused in on that $55,000, depending on how you calculate the interest, and then the actual award being around $20,000. And I think the, again, some of the challenges here is that the way it was, I don't want to say erroneously calculated on some of the payments being applied to personal property, which then in essence accelerated the how quickly we get to the limits. I think if you look at the special verdict form and then compare those numbers for actual cash value, and again, this is where I can understand why some might be some confusion here. But as Mr. Tobin, I think, aptly pointed out, Auto Owners has waived this replacement cost value issue. That's why they paid this amount. And so this has been paid. This is an actual cash value claim and amount. And therefore, some of these, like the $10,000 payment on February 12th was for living expenses. So when we're calculating what's available for interest up into the limit, many of those reductions would not apply. And I just think that should be very careful when calculating the amount. There's no dispute prejudgment interest should be paid here, but on what balance and what limit is available. So if you're looking at the special verdict form and the amount of interest, I'll just say the gap up until the limit is much larger than Auto Owners would like this court to believe. And perhaps the district court made that same mistake accepting Auto Owners' position through this process. But the court can see that this is not a replacement cost value issue. And these payments, again, which are being offset, many of which don't apply, particularly the $10,000 one. So there's a lot more interest available, even up until the limit, if this court finds that Lessard applies and which portion of the statute and the cost value applies. So when doing that calculation, again, undeveloped in the record, perhaps as to how many times we can rebring motions back to the district court to flush some of these errors out. And perhaps we should do more motions for amended findings, but that's our position, Your Honor, that there is a significant amount of available coverage, both between the ALE at 49,000 and within the original cash value portion up and to the limits if this court decides to go that way. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate the answers to our questions today and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an order in the statutory time period. You each have a good day.